right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing great, Jay. How about yourself?
Doing well, doing well. So, as always, one of the things we talk about when we first start this show up is we ask if you like the show, if you appreciate it, and if you think it's fun. We always ask, go ahead to iTunes, leave us a rating, leave us a review, tell us how much you love us, tell Neil how much you love him.
He needs all of it. Do not fail to do this.
Yeah, he needs that. It's important to him. All right, so it's the end of September, so all the kids now are back to school. Parents are happy. Considering that I live in Atlanta, I'm not as thrilled. My kids are out of school, but the only thing is I have to deal with the residual traffic from everybody having gone back to school, which makes my commute worse, which makes me hate kids. No, I'm just kidding. But back to school. So a perfect time to talk about an issue. Neil, I know that you're a supporter of school choice. I'm a supporter of school choice. I'm a supporter of charter schools. I don't like the term alternative forms of education, but I am a supporter of, unique and new ways for kids to be educated.
Well, I think I'm in the same boat there, Jay. I'd like to learn more about school choice. I grew up, I went to private school. I had the luxury or the privilege, however you want to say it, to go to a private school. But most people do not have that kind of luxury. And most private schools aren't even all that great. So we need to do something about our educational system.
Right. And so who better than somebody who has a passion for that and works with that every day? If you've been around for the last few years, you know her. She's been on CNN, MSNBC as a reporter. And now she is if I'm not mistaken, devoted to election, education advocacy in different forms. And we'll kind of get into that. And so Campbell Brown is here with us. Campbell, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Jay, Neil. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. It's funny. We contacted you a couple of months ago, actually, to kind of get this worked out. And so we're happy we're able to kind of bring it together. And the timing has worked out pretty well. So, before we get started, in some more in depth about school choice and charter schools, kind of give us your background and what, what was it? You went from being a television reporter, you were covering campaigns. In fact, prior to the start, Campbell, I was telling her about how I remember she covered the George W. Bush campaign back in 2000, during that fateful
I remember those days.
The hanging Chad election. And so
we could not get out of Austin, Texas.
We were stuck there. And it's like almost until like November before things were settled. But since that time, your life has kind of changed. You got married, so you have kids now. And so what was it that kind of got you going on educational advocacy? What kind of turned you on to that, and what made that become a big part of your life?
Well, I'll tell you a story. It was a friend of mine who was going through a very personal experience that sort of opened my eyes to some of the challenges in our educational system. I mean, I think like most people, I didn't think about it at all until I had kids of my own. We were just not focused on it, maybe as a policy issue here and there, but I really hadn't given it much thought. I was hosting my own show at CNN at the time, and I had just had a baby, had another one on the way, and, recognized that my kids were going to have a lot of opportunities given the position I had, and I had had some career success. And so I it didn't occur to me. I wasn't thinking about, challenges that most people are facing when they think about public school. And I had a close friend who worked with me at CNN. She did hair and makeup for TV talent. And we'd known each other for years, even back in my NBC days. And she came into work one day. Well, she had a little boy. She was a single mom. She had a little boy. And she was always struggling with, daycare because she didn't make a lot of money. So she'd bring him into work a lot. He'd sit in my lap while she did my hair and got me ready to go on the air. And I remember her one day coming into work, and she was so upset. And I said to her, what's wrong? And she said, I started to look at schools to try to figure out where my little boy would go. And I just found out that the school that I'm zoned for, where I live in New York, is one of the worst schools in New York City. And it's a terrible school. It's not a safe school. And I don't know what I'm going to do. And she was so upset. And I mean, I remember her coming to work crying and, you know, in a total state of distress about this. And she looked at the Catholic school that was in her neighborhood, but it was too expensive. And I remember looking up charter schools with her, and I think it was the first time in my life that I had ever heard of a charter school. And she didn't know what she was going to do. She was a mess. This went on and on. And then one day she comes into work, and she's got this big smile on her face, and she says, I have great news. I've solved my school problem. I said, what? Thinking she'd come into money or something to pay for private school. And she told me that she had a client, and this woman, and she did her hair, who lived in a really great neighborhood on the Upper East Side of New York that was in that was near one of the best public schools in New York City. And she told me, I've agreed to do my friend, my client's hair for free for the rest of her life if she will let me use her address and claim it as mine so that my little boy can go to that school.
Oh, boy.
I looked at her, and I looked at her, and I said, you're crazy. You can't do this. You're going to get in so much trouble. This is insane. And by the way, I think it's illegal, which it is.
Right.
And she just looked at me, and she said, what would you do? What if we were talking about your kids? What would you do for your children? And, I mean, it was just like a slap in the face, you know? I mean, about sort of with the bubble I was living in. And I mean, I think we all know what wouldn't we do to give our kids a decent education and to make sure that our children are safe. We would do anything. We would do absolutely anything. And it was just this huge wake up call for me. And it was the first time I really started using, I think, the platform that I had a little bit at CNN to start exploring the issue. I started reading more. I had Eva Moskowitz, who runs a very successful charter school in New York, come on my show. It's the first time I'd ever met her. I now serve on her board, and we're very close, and I'm heavily involved in her schools. But I just got deeper and deeper involved and sort of, you know, I approach this as a journalist, right? I spent my whole career in pretty mainstream journalism. I mean, I was hired for my first network television job by Tim Russert, who was very old school. And I was trained in that, you know, way of thinking that, you know, our job as reporters is basically to just referee the match and not take positions on any issues. But to me, this was so clear that there were no two sides. You know, what parent would not want to make their own decisions about their children's education? What parent would not want more educational choices? And the way our system is designed, it denies parents the most basic rights and opportunities. And, you know, we claim that, you know, we are the land of opportunity, and that's what America is all about. And the truth is the system is so rigged against you if you don't have any money. And after I left CNN, I just sort of fell deeper and deeper down this rabbit hole and began to speak out publicly about some of this stuff. And that's when I ran into the teachers unions for the first time and discovered that that this issue to a lot of people was not so black and white. I still believe it's black and white, but I now have, you know, a much, I think, deeper appreciation for the politics and how ugly it is, really, around, you know, what should be all of our, you know, united focus on trying to do what's best for children in this country.
Well, that, you know, when you start talking about the teachers unions, and, you know, it's unfortunately an issue where it becomes a very partisan divide. But tell us a little bit about, you know, using what you've learned as a reporter and your skills as a journalist, it's like when you've dug in and you've kind of looked at this, why are the teachers unions? What in the bottom line is like, what is the major reason they are so opposed to any kind of these reforms? It's always a knee jerk no before anything happens.
Well, I mean, this is, you know, that's the, yeah, $25 million question, I guess. First of all, I would dispute that it's as partisan. I mean, I get, it feels very partisan, especially in the context of this presidential campaign. But Barack Obama was a pretty strong supporter of school choice, or at least charter schools. I wouldn't go so far. He was not in favor of vouchers, but a huge advocate of charter schools. And Democrats have been, I think, very divided on this. You know, Secretary Clinton has the endorsement of the teachers union, so she has sort of dialed back the support she used to give charter schools because she needs them at this particular moment. I'm hoping she'll go back to her original position when this campaign is over. But it's, you know, it's just a power play. It's just, you know, bare knuckled politics. It's an absolute power play. And I'll give you an example of how I sort of got deeper into it, and things got fairly nasty in terms of my dealings with the teachers unions. They came after me pretty aggressively. I, you know, as I got more involved, I started writing op-eds and speaking out about this, and I'm looking for story ideas. One day I open up one of the New York tabloids, the New York Daily News, and there's this huge story about these 14 teachers in New York City who had engaged in inappropriate sexual behavior with children, and they still had their jobs. And I thought, okay, this is a tabloid story. They're making this up. This can't be true. I look into it a little bit. I start reading about it, and there's this crazy state law that's on the books in New York and a number of other states that gives school employees, tenured teachers, greater protections than any other public employee has. And so something so outrageous as abuse of a child can happen, and there is enormous power given to these so-called independent arbitrators that, you know, are chosen jointly by the teachers' unions, and they give very lenient sentences to teachers who've done some pretty crazy things. And it's like no rational person would ever think that that's okay, that it's, you know, that any school employee who's ever harmed a child should still be allowed back in the classroom. It's insane. So, you know, if you asked a room full of people, raise your hand if you think we should change this law, every person would raise their hand. So I read about this. I write a piece about it, and nothing happens. And I think, you know what, I'm going to raise a little money. We're going to start a campaign in New York. We're going to go to Albany. We're going to get this law changed because this is a crazy law. No reasonable person could think this is okay. So we you know, ran an advocacy campaign around it, got some attention for it. But nothing. We could not get anyone to move in Albany. And I was like, I mean, to me, it's like, what? Why would the teachers unions ever want to be in the position of defending? I mean, I understand, like, you want to fight for your people, great teachers, of course, and try to get them better pay. And like, all that I get. But why would they ever want to put themselves in the position of having to defend teachers who've hurt kids? It made no sense to me. And they are defending this law to the death. There is no legislative movement on it because the teachers union is the most powerful political force in New York state politics and local politics. And I, you know, I've sort of come to believe that their view, because I make a distinction between union leadership and the people they represent. I, you know, most teachers I talk to think the law is crazy and ought to be changed. But I think the union leadership wants to project to their people that, you know, look, we care about you so much. We're willing to, you know, if we're willing to defend this awful person who's done this terrible thing, imagine what we will do for you if you, you know, if you get into a fight with your principal or something. I you know, it just makes no sense to me. But they do. So we have sent the parents I got to know, who were the parents of children who had been victimized. And it's not just the abuse piece. I mean, that's the most egregious examples. But you know, cases where you'd have, you know, a teacher who literally would not show up for half the year.
Right, so just plain incompetence, too.
Totally. And so, you know, and they're protected under tenure rules. So the parents have filed a lawsuit. I founded a nonprofit that helped find pro bono legal support. Fantastic lawyer Jay Lefkowitz, who works for Kirkland Ellis, has taken on the case for free. God love him. and is representing these parents, and they're challenging teacher tenure laws and these dismissal protections and the last in, first out seniority law that exists in New York and many other places. That means if there ever have to be layoffs, that they're determined entirely based on seniority. They have the same law in California. It's so insane that the teacher of the year in California got laid off. So they brought a similar lawsuit in California that unfortunately the Supreme Court, they initially won, the Supreme Court overturned it. In New York, the lawsuit that these parents have brought that I'm supporting and helping them is, you know, the judge has so far ruled in their favor as the unions in the state have tried to get the case thrown out. So it's making its way through the courts. But, you know, the legislative process in a state like New York, where they have that much political power, is just, you know, you're banging your head against a wall. And so legal action on something like this probably sounds a little bit extreme, but if you're a parent in that situation, you know, why wouldn't you ask a judge to do the right thing when clearly these politicians aren't going to? So I don't know how it's going to turn out. We've since filed a second lawsuit in Minnesota as well. And there are parents in New Jersey who've been reaching out to us to try to do something similar there. So, you know, I think nothing speaks louder than parents who are willing to stand up. And I will do whatever I can to use whatever platform I can to help raise money, find lawyers, do whatever. But when parents are willing to put themselves out there like that, I think it speaks volumes about how much mm-hmm. the system needs to change.
Mm-hmm. Campbell, do you know offhand, like, when these this situation sort of arose in New York? Because I think back the depictions of teachers and that sort of thing in the culture didn't ever used to reference this sort of thing. I mean, there was never any question that if someone was incompetent, unfit to teach, that they would be able to be dismissed or replaced, what have you. When did this all take hold? Do you know?
Well, I think part of the problem is it's not just state law, but in states where the union is very strong, like New York and California, you have contracts that are negotiated at the local level that add on even more protections on top of existing law. So it has made it, you know, if you have someone who comes in and tries to reform things and change the system, Joel Klein, I think, is a good example, who was the chancellor of New York City Schools under Mike Bloomberg, who came in and really tried to shake things up and do things differently. And to a certain extent, I mean, they accomplished a lot, and charter schools are, you know, thriving in New York to their credit. But to a certain extent, their hands are tied by what's in these contracts, which override everything. So it's, you know, I know so many people at the state level, because these really, you know, this isn't so much a federal fight. These are all state laws, and so the fights are sort of different in all the different states. But so many people who are in the trenches at the state level who are trying to, you know, superintendents and local legislators who are trying to change things, but feel really handcuffed by these contracts on top of laws that you know, the politics makes it incredibly hard to change.
All right, so let's shift gears a little bit and talk about, and this is funny because a lot of people still, and I am not even really sure, and you kind of talked about it, that you said the first time you heard of a charter school. A lot of people don't really know what a charter school is. They know the term, they understand it's a little different from the public schools, and know it's not a private school, but that's really about it. So what kind of, and this is for my benefit as well, because it's,
well, yeah, and mine especially, because Campbell, I want you to assume that I know next to nothing about school choice and charter schools, because that's not far off the truth. So feel free.
Yeah,
feel free,
I mean,
to
I
speak in as remedial a fashion as needed.
So if you could just tell us what a charter school is and how it operates.
I think you're not giving yourself enough credit, but I will pretend that you know nothing. So a charter school, and they're you know, for the most part all over the country now. But the idea behind charter schools was a public school, free schools, you know, taxpayer funded, that don't have to play by the same rules as the other schools. That you know, you could create a school that was not confined or limited by the union contracts. So, I mean, I'll just give you an example. The contracts are so crazy. Like in New York, it'll say exactly teachers will work exactly this amount of time. And, you know, they come back to school to prepare, the, you know, day before school starts. And there's very little teacher training and professional development and all that type of thing. But a charter school was, is, those rules are all waived for a charter school so that they could be a place of innovation where you could, they could experiment, try new things, do different things with teacher training and different curriculums to figure out what works and then take those great ideas, hopefully, and, you know, apply them to a traditional district school. So, you know, they don't have to play by the same rules, I guess is the easiest way to explain it, but it's a totally a public school, free school, in New York. Now any, you'll hear these critiques of charter schools where they say, oh, the reason charter schools are so successful and the kids do so much better is that they only take the best and the brightest kids. Well, that's just false. In New York, it is a law that charter schools have to accept children by lottery, giving deference to the kids who live in that neighborhood. For the most part, charters are in really poor neighborhoods where parents don't have any other choices. Harlem has, you know, it's, I think it's almost 35-40% charter today because, you know, when charters were first getting off the ground, many launched there. And by lottery, there's a lottery. You know, names get picked out. There's a movie that was made about this, a documentary called The Lottery. It's the most heartbreaking thing you've ever seen because there are, in New York City today, almost 45,000 kids on the charter school wait list. So there are not enough seats for all the families that want to go. So when lottery day happens, and it's literally they're pulling names out of a hat to see which kids will go, imagine, you know, you're a mother whose kid is, you know, has no choice and you don't get in because you don't win the lottery. I mean, it is the most heartbreaking thing in the world. And we can't expand fast enough to accommodate the needs of all these families. You know, I'm on the board of Success Academies, which is the the largest and the highest performing charter school network in New York, in New York City. And it was founded by a couple of guys and run by this woman who's become pretty famous, I think, in the education movement named Eva Moskowitz. And she is, you know, it's run very differently than a traditional school. The kids go to school much longer than they do in a traditional school. That they start earlier, they get out later, the days are longer, the teachers work longer hours, they get paid more. The curriculum's very tough. The standards are very high. It is a traditional, you know, what's kind of referred to as a no excuses, environment where, you know, there is discipline, there is order, the kids are in uniform. It's creating structure that many of these kids don't have in their lives. But I'll tell you what, there are more than, I think the numbers, if I have it accurate, around 74% of the kids in the Success Academy network are disadvantaged kids. They're on free or reduced price lunch, which is how the government keeps track of, you know, where they are on the poverty scale. So most of these kids are poor. Most of these kids are minorities. And yet the top five schools in New York State, the top five public schools in math are all Success Academy charter schools. I mean, this includes the gifted and talented. So when you hear people say poverty, you know, we can't do anything about our education system until we solve poverty. We've got to pour more money into it and address poverty. Otherwise, you just can't educate these kids. They're poor, they're minority, they can't be taught. It is a total lie. These kids, my kids play chess and they go to the national chess tournament every year. And I'm so proud when I go with them. They're okay chess players, but Success Academies has this, you know, has almost 200 kids who go to the national tournament in chess and they're amazing. I mean, they're just thriving in a way. I mean, I think these schools are better than some of the top private schools in New York City. So to say, to make this argument that we hear over and over again, that kids who are poor can't learn is just not true. We're just not teaching them. We're not giving them great schools. So it's heartbreaking to me. I mean, you've got a million people nationally on charter school wait list. It's about 100,000 in LA. It's about 20,000 in Chicago. I'm going to Chicago tomorrow to speak to the big charter school network there called Noble that's having incredible success. But the unions view charters, because most of them are not union schools. So they do not have union teachers. They do not have to abide by the contracts. And because they're not union schools, the unions view them as an existential threat. And they want to stop them from growing and expanding. So it is an absolute battle. In Boston, which has the highest performing charters in the country, I mean, the Boston charter schools have basically closed the achievement gap, which is the gap between how white children in this country perform and how African Americans and Hispanics perform. And this gap has really not closed over the last 20 to 30 years. Boston is closing it because those schools are amazing. And there's a ballot initiative that they're going to vote on in November that Charlie Baker, the governor there, is aggressively supporting to expand the number of charter schools, to lift the cap on the number of charter schools. There's a law that caps them in Boston to give more of these families these incredible schools. And the union is spending $30 million to try to force a loss on this ballot initiative. It's insane. It makes no sense. And I don't know how you can claim to be a progressive. I don't know how you can claim to embrace, you know, the Democratic Party's agenda and claim to care about poor people and not want to create more, better schools for disadvantaged kids. It's like there's such a disconnect in my brain. I can't even, you know, and I know the arguments about, you know, well, we can't, what about the kids who get left behind, who don't get into the charter schools? And the way I think about that is, you know, these schools, they're a lifeboat. And we're pulling as many kids into the lifeboat as we possibly can. And, if you're flying by the Titanic, do you say, I'm not going to stop unless I can save everyone? No, you save as many people as you can. That's what we're doing. We're going to pull as many kids into these lifeboats as we possibly can. And they're not going to be able to stop it because these communities are too invested now. They are normalized, these schools, they've become part of the system, and they are giving parents who desperately need it another choice.
So I think it's clear that, you know, this is a systemic issue. The problem lies with our educational system as a whole. And I sort of view the movement for school choice and charter schools and the like as a bit of a backlash, a bit of a correction, and not to get too esoteric here, but if you're familiar with the history of public education in the United States, which I am only glancingly, one thing I do recall is that in the 1800s, for most of our history up until the 1800s, there was no public education system to speak of. Primary education was practically non-existent. But what happened was they imported a Prussian model of education, which was geared towards building up, you know, the citizen who would serve the state. This gets into all sorts of weird political philosophy stuff I'd rather not get too sunk into, but I have to say that if you look at the historical realities of education, our modern system is the aberration. And I think we're now, after 100 years of this, we're finding out it doesn't work very well for everybody. Especially when you add self-interested teachers' unions into the mix, you might be able to get by on the public education system as it exists, but not when you start to put teachers' unions ahead of the well-being of students.
I think you're right in so many ways, because it's not just about what we've been talking about, which are the most disadvantaged kids in this country. I mean, I think what you're laying out applies to all kids, which is we've had this sort of factory model, right?
Right.
Teachers standing in front of the classroom at the blackboard and all the kids in the desk lined up in a row.
It was explicitly a factory model, as in, you know, manufacture good citizens so that the state can utilize their talents to the benefit of the state. And right. I don't want to sound too libertarian here, but
but that's not the world we live in anymore, no. In any way. And like everything in our lives has been disrupted and changed, except for our education system. And I would argue some of the private schools, some of the best public schools, you know, that people think of as the best public schools in New York or anywhere else in this country aren't that great either. I mean, there is so much has evolved in terms of the science around how kids learn and what we know and our ability to give personalized learning to kids through technology and really tap into their talents. And it's basic stuff. Like just to give you an example, you know, imagine, you know, a normal public school teacher in a middle-class neighborhood. She's got 30 kids in the class, and she's trying to teach basic math, right? So some kids in that class are going to be really good at math, and they're going to move ahead really quickly. And they're going to understand what she's taught them probably in the first few minutes of the class, and then they're going to sit there bored for the rest of the class, right? There are going to be some kids in the middle who she's kind of teaching to, and then some kids who struggle with it, who may, you know, not be great at math, who fall behind. So that teacher, there's no way she has time to give individualized learning to all these kids, right? So she basically teaches to the middle. So you have the kids on one end who get completely left behind, and then the kids on the other end who aren't being challenged and get bored. There's like basic technology available now that would allow, you know, math to be personalized so that the teacher can say to this group of kids who got it really quickly, okay, you go on and do these next 20 problems and see how, you know, and I'm going to focus on these kids who need extra help. And this stuff exists. We're not talking about inventing new software or anything. It's out there. It's just that this is, you know, I mean, think about, you know, healthcare, I think, is the only industry I can think of that is as entrenched at, you know, in bureaucratic, really. And I would argue that healthcare has been disrupted more than education, as education. So even like really basic changes that we could make in our thinking about teaching or about the technology we use or any of this stuff, it's really hard to get it into the classroom. And so, you know, we're at this moment in this country where, you know, we're sort of seeing all this play out, I think, in this election, where, you know, the our economy is changed in a way that we're never going back to how it used to be. Manufacturing jobs are never coming back in the same way that they were in this country. We have to retrain.
Yes.
You know, this entire country in terms of like how we think about future employment for our kids. There was this World yeah. Economic Forum study that came out that said something like 60% of the jobs that our kids are going to have do not currently exist. How do we teach kids for that? I mean, it's, you know, and certainly not using the model we have now. So having great charter schools or great, you know, great private school, where anywhere that there can be some innovation and experimentation, I think is great. Anything that's trying to disrupt this bureaucracy, because boy, is it one, only good. Only good for our kids.
Right. I don't know if you know, Sir Ken Robinson is –
Oh, yeah. He's fantastic.
Yes, amazing. And I always remember there was a TED talk that he did that somebody had turned into an animation called The Changing the Education Paradigms, and talking about where, you know, we're killing creativity among kids because we've got them kind of locked into this kind of, you know, factory, the mentality. You know, it's like, you know, their bells ring and they move to a different class and they're grouped together by age and grouped to, you know, and it's like we can unlock so much other stuff if we allow that kind of creativity to take place in our educational system. We had spoken with Mike Rowe and we talked about, you know, and I remember this when I was in high school, there was a program for some kids to go. They would be in regular school in the morning and in the afternoon they'd go to a vocational high school. And that seems to be something that is not, you know, you don't see that as much anymore because it came into this situation where it was like everybody must go to college, but not everybody is a college type student. And so you see this, and I'm sure you've read about, you know, you're in New York, so you know this, where it's like, in SUNY and everything, where, you know, like 90% of the freshman class have to take remedial courses because they're not necessarily adequately prepared to go to college. So I think that, you know, it's important. And I'm wondering, you know, do the so the charter schools, you say they don't operate because of the success that they're having. Is it because they're taking advantage of educating kids in ways that they don't, that maybe the public schools aren't?
Yes. But I would even go to your bigger point about this to me is I think a failure of the education reform movement, if you want to call it that, is in part the point you just made, that this idea that everybody has to go to college. There's a backlash associated with that now that we've realized that, guess what, most of our kids are not prepared for college after they graduate K through 12 anyway. But they're burdened with this debt and they're not getting jobs. So we're rethinking this, and there's been a real resurgence around, you know, the work that's being done and the money that's being spent on the technical education side. But I also think, you know, this goes to that one size fits all model. This is another mistake that I think the ed reform community made in trying to solve, you know, problems that were plaguing what was going on in schools that serve mainly disadvantaged kids. You know, they decided that, testing, you know, we've got to see them move up on, you know, their math scores and their reading scores. And you know, there was a period of time where we thought that kids, you know, amounted essentially to their math score and their reading score, and we weren't thinking about the whole child. And there was a real backlash, and most of it was associated with Common Core, but I think, honestly, it was more about the testing piece of it, which is, you know, there was a movement to address what needed to be addressed in sort of these failing schools, which is we need an independent measure of what's really going on in that school that's failing, because that mother, you know, hears from her teacher that everything's fine and her kid keeps getting socially promoted and all of a sudden he's in 10th grade and he can't read. So they needed some independent measure to say, okay, what's really happening with this kid? We need to know by third grade, otherwise he's doomed. But that's different than than the challenges that, you know, that parents were facing in a suburban middle class school, where all of a sudden the same solution, let's focus our time and attention on rigorous testing around, you know, math and English, where these parents are more worried about, you know, how do I get more AP classes for my kid, or how do I get them ready for the SATs, or, you know, it's a one size, this is how government solves problems. It's a one size fits all solution to every problem. And it, you know, this is where, you know, local community, it needs to have a say in what really is happening in their school. And I think we saw parents assert themselves around this big fight around Common Core and testing to say, you know, this one size fits all thing doesn't work. And I really do hope that that's a lesson learned. You know, that and this idea, every kid must go to college, you know, these sort of, we abide by these, you know, 10 commandments of ed reform, you know, well, it doesn't work that way. So, you know, these battles, you hope, you know, don't get entrenched on both sides, so that the people who are trying to change things and make them better also are willing to iterate when they make mistakes and make sure that going forward, it doesn't happen again.
Well, I think what's one of the rare areas where we see some kind of bipartisan cooperation, don't you? I think that everybody who has kids wants the best for their kids, and this is not a Democrat or Republican issue. This is an American issue. So I think that.
Boy, I wish we were talking about it more, though.
Yeah. Well, here we are.
Yeah, well, right, we are. I mean, this, like, when was the last time either of these presidential candidates, I mean, you don't, you know,
no,
it just doesn't
up.
Get the last, I mean, going back to the 2000 campaign, I mean, that was the last time we heard a presidential candidate. George W. Bush made it pretty central to his campaign, but, you know, maybe it has to be times of peace and prosperity where people aren't feeling this anxiety that you can have these conversations. I don't know. Frustrating.
Yeah, let's shift gears for a bit and talk about the $74 million, which is you're one of the co-founders of this organization. Kind of tell everybody, you know, what it is that this is about. What's the purpose and the mission behind this, and where the name comes from.
Sure. So I got pretty heavily involved on the advocacy side with the schools and doing these lawsuits, but I obviously journalism is my love and what I know. So I launched with a good friend what we're calling the 74. It's for 74 million kids in this country under the age of 18. And it's a nonprofit news site that covers education and these policy issues that we're talking about and tries to, A, bring some truth to the conversation because there's so much misinformation that gets put out there so that we can correct the record and make sure that parents really, you know, are armed with the facts when they're trying to make these decisions. And cover the policy fights and the politics around this, because it's, like I was saying before, it's every state is different. The state laws are different. The way they approach it is different. So it's there's so much going on, because it's not just sort of one big federal fight. And it just, you know, as you've seen media, you know, the big media companies kind of implode over the last, you know, 5-10 years, that the education coverage, you know, whether it's newspapers, certainly television doesn't give it any, has really gone by the wayside. So hopefully we're filling a much needed niche with this site, and it's going really well so far. We've been around for about a year, and we have 14 reporters. We have a new LA bureau that just opened, and an LA it's called LA School Report. That's an offshoot for any of your Los Angeles listeners. So, it's, you know, I still believe, maybe I'm naive, but I do still believe in journalism, and that, you know, telling stories can be a way to get people's attention. And so I wanted to, you know, stay in that mix, and, there's been some pretty interesting stuff. So I encourage all your listeners to go check it out.
Yeah, I'm looking around and it's, you know, I was looking at it before, and some really good stuff here. I mean, and you cover a wide gamut of you know, issues and opinions, and you know, it you know, it doesn't look like you have, it's not overtly partisan. You know, that's, which I think is good in this way, because I don't think it's as much of a partisan issue as you think it is. And you know, I watch one of the few cable shows that I watch is The Five on Fox, and I know that Juan Williams is a very big, even though he's a progressive, he's a liberal, but he's a very big supporter of school choice, and so there are people there that are doing that. And so I think it's, you know, this is great, because this is looks like something where, you know, you may be able to bridge some of those gaps in you know, kind of a shared common purpose in improving the educational system in this country.
Yeah, and I believe in debate. You know, there's plenty on the site that you know, would not be my point of view that I might disagree with, but I would be the first to change my mind if somebody makes a better case for you know, going in a different direction than I would. So I like healthy debate. I want there to be, you know, aggressive, you know, conflict around ideas that hopefully leads us to better solutions. What I don't like is, you know, is misleading information. And that is what we're trying to do. Let's have healthy debate, but let's make it fact-based. Right. So, I mean, a lot of what you'll see on the site is, I mean, going back to charter schools, is there's a flashcard thing. There's so many, you know, if you listen to opponents of charter schools, they will say they're private schools, a lie. You know, we can have rigorous, intense debates, but they have to be grounded in fact. You know, and again, going back to this presidential campaign, that's, you know, the fact checking piece is completely missing. And we, you know, if we can just educate people a little more about education, then I think that's a positive. So hopefully that's, you know, what we're accomplishing, or at least trying to.
Well, it does look like you've got some very good content on there. I'm actually scrolling through one of the stories right now because it caught my eye. Analysis, new warnings of teacher shortage sound like deja vu all over again. This is by Mike Antonucci, and he's sort of letting the air out of the balloon from this sort of not quite hysterical, I wouldn't say that, but certainly a little bit alarmist note that this woman what's her name?
Linda Darling-Hammond.
Linda Darling-Hammond. She's sounding the alarm on the coming crisis due to a teacher shortage.
She has been for a long time. There's been a coming crisis for quite some time.
he shows that she almost word for word made the same prediction in 1984. So that kind of skeptical perspective where you question these people, because that's valuable, because I think culturally we have arrived at a place now where teachers are viewed with some mix of pity and adoration and hero worship, because they're so influential in our children's lives and they're paid so very little. And even though they get 3 months off in the summer, which I would dearly love to have as a working person, we've got to always be striving, striving to protect the teachers and their rights. So poking a little hole in this and saying, actually, maybe it's not so bad, teachers. That, I think, is a very valuable perspective, especially because it's done in a respectful way, not the way I would do it, but definitely, I think, a valuable perspective there. So people should check out the 74, yes. The 74
well,
million.
You. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it looks great. And it's interesting because you're talking about the coming shortage of teachers, and I have just been, I'm actually writing a piece about, there's a professor from Kennesaw State University talking about the economics of school choice. And essentially what he did was he was looking at increases in funding in public education and where the money was going. And guess what? It wasn't going towards hiring more teachers. A good portion of it was going towards administrators and other staff.
No.
Shocking, isn't
Not
it?
Not the bureaucracy.
No. But what's really interesting about this was, like, we're not talking about like 49 to 51%. I mean, we're talking about like 83%. In Colorado, for example, the staffing surge between 1992 and 2014, 83% of it went towards administrators and other staff. It's insane how much money has been spent at the increases in education. And again, all we ever hear a lot of times, especially from, the same old people, is we don't have enough money. We're not spending enough money. We need more investment in our education. And if we were to look at it over the last 30 years, how much money we've spent on education, it's kind of ridiculous. And, if those charter schools that you're talking about that can operate in some of the poorest areas of New York and Boston and other areas
on
can
less
be
money
successful.
Too. Charter
and,
schools exactly. generally get less money from the state than a traditional school.
And that's the thing.
But they're doing it on less.
Right. So that's the thing that drives me crazy is like, and who out there can present that message to people? Because I think if I especially when you look at, if we're talking politics here and Republicans want to make more inroads with minority communities, then, something like this, the education is such a big issue. You'd think that they would try a little bit harder. It seems like there's always kind of lip service played to school choice, but how much of it is are they going to do the work? It's going to take a while to do it, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because Washington, I think, also tiptoes around this because they're, Republicans in Washington, their view is basically, let's just block grant all the money, send it back to the states, get rid of the Department of Education. So it's really not our problem. And I think that's a cop-out. I really do. I think, I think they need to, you can't, especially a party that's in crisis somewhat like Republicans, although I would argue Democrats are in a similar place, maybe not so extreme, but like if you're going to articulate a vision for the future of this country, given the challenges we're facing right now, you have to be able to explain what public education is going to look like and how we get our kids ready for this future and how we get the kids who are about to graduate ready for college, if they're going to go or what the other opportunities are going to be. And the fact that it is just getting lip service, given some of the challenges headed our way, is insane to me.
Yeah, and it's going to take a political will out there sometimes I don't think exists, but it's an issue that I think a lot of people are paying attention to. And you talked before about lotteries and stuff like that. And I think there was another you mentioned a documentary, and I had seen one, and you've probably seen it, Waiting for Superman, where they had a similar situation where the kids were waiting on a lottery, and it's heartbreaking. You're watching; they're sitting there, these parents in this huge auditorium, not an auditorium, a gymnasium or something, and they're spinning these balls like they would a raffle, and you know they don't get selected, and it's just it's
heartbreaking.
It is. It's terrible. It's terrible. They want they just want a good education for their kids, and they have to rely on a lottery in order to do it. Okay, so I think we're trying to wrap up here. Campbell, this was really great. Neil, I don't know if you have any other questions or anything.
Well, no. Campbell, it was an education. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you guys for spending an hour on this at a time when it's, you know, it's certainly hard to get a lot of people focused. So it's, you know, it's getting the word out to people about how sort of urgent these challenges are. I hope we can.
Yeah, no, this was great, and I really appreciate it. And I think, you know, I learned something, and I'm sure people who are going to listen to this are going to learn as well. Now, indeed, before you go, you know, as we talked, we were just having a very casual conversation. There's no gotcha questions or anything like that, except we do have one.
We do have the one gotcha. And
yeah, what is it?
Okay, we're going to lay it on you here. And it's an important cultural question, perhaps not as important as reforming the education system, but perhaps...
close.
Perhaps close. And that question, Campbell, is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Wait, what?
That's our gotcha question.
Yeah, that's our gotcha question.
I just want to reassure you that no matter how you answer, it will not affect our opinion of you in the slightest bit.
Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Okay, so you want to know my honest truth? Mm-hmm. I have not seen Die Hard.
No.
Well,
but if it's not like Frozen or, you know, I have little kids.
You and I are both, you know, Gen Xers. This was from 1986 or something like that. I mean,
Die Hard. You mean the Bruce Willis Die Hard? Explain this question to me.
I think your natural skepticism here, Campbell, is something that I share. And I think maybe, Jay, we should count this as a heck no.
No.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
I'm very curious as to where you're going with this.
Well, thank you. Well, she says it's preposterous.
No, I guarantee. Okay. I think that she should ask her husband, Dan, a very intelligent person, what he thinks. I guarantee he's probably seen the movie. And he would answer truthfully.
I'm sure he has.
So you can email us, and we'll count it. We'll just sit there and say whatever answer he gives.
Jay Campbell said no. She said it is not a Christmas movie.
She hasn't seen it. She can't.
There's clearly a backstory here that I'm missing, but I hope to get it someday.
There's a very big debate over whether or not the movie is considered quote unquote a Christmas movie because it takes place during Christmas. There's some Christmas themes to it. Neil is of the opinion it's not, that Christmas is incidental to the movie. Somebody like me says no, that the movie couldn't happen without the Christmas holiday based upon the story
Which, all of this is nonsense. Campbell
yes.
has clearly
That's
made
why
her
we have fun doing it. Yeah.
That it is a no, which I think
I would go no. Yeah.
Yes. That's clear as day. Clear as day.
Okay.
Mark it no.
All right, Die Hard Christmas movie. Okay,
I'd still like to know what Dan thinks of that, though.
How did I miss this? It's just like this must be it's just a Twitter thing. Yeah,
it's a Twitter. Thing.
I've tried to take a little Twitter break lately, but
me too. It's great.
The campaign
Sometimes
is
you
too depressing.
It.
So periodically, you just have to shut it down. But I'm glad you had alerted me to the Die Hard Christmas movie debate.
It's an important issue.
I'll tune back in and check it out.
All right,
Campbell. Well, thank you again. So much for being with us and talking with us about school choice, and we really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. All right, and that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. I'm Jay Caruso. For Neil Dewing, we will see you next time.